Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
What is up, fight fans? Another edition of Inside Boxing Live. I am your host, Dan Canoba. We have a big one for you today as all things culminate this Saturday. Arguably the biggest fight card of the year. We got Canelo Alvarez taking on Danny Jacobs out in Las Vegas. Joining us to talk about the fight is the man that will be calling the fight. SI.com's Chris Mannix will be in the booth alongside Brian Kenny and Sergio Mora, and he'll break down what he thinks is going to happen in the ring, as well as Anthony Joshua's future opponent, who I think will be announced any minute now. So Chris Mannix will join us, as well as Rob Perez, but you know him as Worldwide Wob. I collaborated with him on a very funny story that he came up with about NBA basketball players and their inefficiency to land any punches when they get into brawls. So we'll talk about some of the biggest fights in NBA history. We'll have some fun with that. But obviously, the biggest fight of the year, at least for the first half of 2019, is just a few days away, and that's Canelo and Jacobs. And right now, I want to do a little preview here and show you why, and I poured over the numbers, and I want to show you why that I think that this fight will be more of a calculated chess match than a brawl. And I'll start with the fact that both fighters throw under the middleweight average for punches thrown. The middleweight average is somewhere around 55, 56, and Canelo comes in there throwing 44 punches around. Jacobs throws 47 punches around, but they are very efficient. Canelo lands above average. Lands above average 46% of his shots. Jacobs around 42. That leads me to believe that the fact that they don't throw as many punches, they're under 50, but when they do throw their punches, they land, they find their mark. So there it is. There's going to be pockets of this fight where there's some really, really a good action. Another reason why I think this fight is going to be very close: both fighters have above average defense. Neither guy gets credited for their defense, especially Canelo Alvarez. But you take a look at opponents, Canelo's opponents, they land just 8 power punches around. Take a look at Jacob's opponents, even better than Canelo. They're landing 7 power punches around. The middleweight average for power punches landed in a round is 12. So both guys are going to be elusive. Both guys use lateral movement, which leads me to my next point and why I ultimately think that Canelo will win a unanimous decision, is that Canelo is going to target the body of Jacobs. One thing Jacobs does well is he moves around the ring. He's a lot of lateral movement, and one way to stop movement is to go to the body. 30% of Canelo Alvarez's landed punches or to the body. So he's going to target the body of Danny Jacobs. He's going to slow him down. And a big reason I don't think Jacobs is going to be able to slow down Canelo is because he doesn't have the best jab. He throws it a lot, but it's not very accurate. He throws 20 jabs and only lands 4 rounds. So therefore, you know, Danny Jacobs has to stop Canelo somehow. You got to use a jab. Look what Golovkin did in their fights, whether you think he won them or not. He was able to slow down Canelo by sticking a jab in there every once in a while. So there it is. I think that Canelo's going to win this fight. But I also think it's going to be, you know, high-powered chess. You hear that a lot in boxing, but it's a cliche, but it works in this one. Not really a brawl, more likely a very, very highly contested fight out in the desert in Las Vegas. All right, but now it's time to get to our interview portion of the show. We're going to talk to a man who will be in the booth on Saturday calling the action. He was Chris Mannix. Our next interview on Inside Boxing Live is brought to you by Jack Doyle's Restaurant and Bar. Jack Doyle's Restaurant and Bar, located just a few steps away from Madison Square Garden and Times Square. Go into Jack Doyle's for all your entertainment needs. From happy hours to birthday parties to private events, Jack Doyle's has you covered. Once again, that's Jack Doyle's Restaurant and Bar, located on 240 West 35th Street. NBA playoffs in full swing, the boxing world seemingly breaking news on a daily basis. It's Chris Mannix, busy season, but he's got some time for us here on Inside Boxing Live. Chris, you got to be downing the coffee right now.
Yeah, a little bit. Certainly the next couple of months, figure to be pretty busy on both boxing and basketball.
Chris, you'll be on the call this Saturday night for Canelo and Jacobs. Going from reporting, now you're in the broadcast booth. What's it been like, man?
It's a new experience. I've been part of broadcasts dating back, last 5 to 10 years, even you know, for Epics and NBC, but those were all sideline gigs, you know, reporting. This is kind of a new experience, but I think I'm settling in okay. I'll let the audience decide.
I think the reviews have been good. Yeah, you're settling in nice. You got to score the fights as well. It's tough. But I think overall, people seem to be happy with your work in the booth. Now, let's talk about the actual fight here between Canelo and Jacobs. And the more that I pore over the numbers and I see that both fighters throw under 50 punches a round, they are pretty efficient, though, with their power shots. Canelo a little bit more than Jacobs. Canelo, obviously, is going to go to the body. Jacobs throws his jab a lot, but it's not enough. He's not really accurate with it. So the more I think about those numbers, leads me to believe that we are heading down a road here where we're going to see another very close decision.
Yeah, I feel the same way. And I honestly don't know which way I'm leaning right now, because I still haven't really formulated a full opinion on how much slippage there's been in Danny Jacobs over the last couple of years. You know, Gennady Golovkin has a way of taking something out of you if you're a fighter that's faced him. We've seen it with a couple of different guys that he's gone up against. And Jacobs, you know, I don't know that Jacobs took a beating in that fight. It certainly was a close fight at Madison Square Garden. But at 32 years old and having experienced a fight like that, I just wonder if he's a little bit lesser than what he was against Golovkin. I was at the Derevchenko fight at the Garden, his last fight. I actually, if I remember correctly, I think I had Derevchenko winning by a point in that fight. It was close. And even if you didn't have Derevchenko winning, you knew it was a very close fight. Canelo's on a different level than Derevchenko. And I know that, you know, A plus B does not equal B plus C, you know, with those types of opponents. But I right now I lean towards Canelo, but I'm still trying to wrap my head around what exactly Danny Jacobs is at this moment.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you bring up with Jacobs, 32 years old, fought Golovkin, you know, went toe-to-toe with him. How much did that take out of him? So what does he have left in the tank come Saturday night? As for Canelo Alvarez, you know, 28 years old, he's been through a lot of wars himself. So you're thinking that Canelo is maybe the fresher fighter?
Yeah, I do. And look, to your point, I think there's a cliff with Canelo that is going to come sooner than probably he wants and his team wants, because of all the tough fights he's been in, dating back to the junior middleweight fights with Aris Landy Lara and Austin Trout, and the tough middleweight fights he's taken with Gennady Golovkin. But at this point, I do think he's still on a bit of an upswing. I mean, he was a better fighter in the second fight against Golovkin, regardless of what you thought about the decision. You know, his decision to take the fight to Golovkin showed me something. His ability to land big punches on Golovkin showed me something. His hand speed, I think, is going to be a big advantage for him in a fight like this against Danny Jacobs. And I know Rocky Fielding, you know, lost before he ever stepped into the ring, but the body attack that Canelo showed in that fight, it really impressed me. So I think Canelo is still trending upwards. I just think at you know, when he hits 30, we might see a reasonably rapid decline.
Yeah, and it's funny because we had matchmaker Golden Boy Robert Diaz on the show, and he told us that he didn't want any part of Lara. He didn't want any part of Trout.
Did he get hit? Let me ask you this, because, and you have the numbers there. Like, I felt that Golovkin, one of the reasons I leaned towards Golovkin in the second fight is that he was just ricocheting that jab off Canelo's head. Like, Canelo wanted to get inside, and Golovkin was landing that. That was a power jab. Like, that's, and to your other point about, you know, Jacobs not jabbing enough, he should look at Golovkin as a blueprint. I know that, you know, he didn't get the decision, but Gennady Golovkin had no problem landing that jab on the head of Canelo Alvarez. Canelo, to his credit, was just willing to fight through it to land the bigger shots.
But going to Canelo in this contract, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, he's got to go through a gauntlet here. I mean, he's fought two fights with Golovkin. You just illustrated all the fights that he had at 154 and 160. Some of the biggest fights, because that's the type of fighter he is. And now with this DAZN deal, this kind of makes things a little different here. In the era of soft touches, in the era of, you know, tune-up fights and the best not fighting the best, that's not going to be able to happen with this new DAZN deal, because, you know, the whole business side of things, they got to add subscribers, and their cash cow is Canelo. So therefore, he has to fight in very tough fights now and in the future.
Yeah, I don't think that DAZN is opposed to paying for the occasional soft touch, the occasional Rocky Fielding type, but at least for 2019, it's this fight, and if he wins, it's Golovkin in September. And look, I've heard some whispers from Canelo's camp about not being thrilled about the idea that they're going to fight Danny Jacobs in May. And Golovkin, most people believe, that is going to get a very easy touch in June, so he'll potentially be the fresher fighter. I do think, though, that Canelo just tends to overrule everybody. You know, he I remember Richard Schaefer, you know, before the Arislandi Lara fight, would say to me that he never wanted that fight, right. And nobody at Golden Boy wanted that fight. Just Canelo is determined to fight the best possible opponents whenever they present themselves. So regardless of what people at Golden Boy think, as long as the deal is right, I think we will see Canelo and Golovkin if they both win in September.
Right. We had Robert Diaz on this show before, and he didn't want Canelo to even go near Trout, didn't want Canelo to go near Lara, and Canelo just straight up said, listen, this is who I'm fighting. Maybe a soft touch in the Canelo world now would be Kovalev, is a name that he's been calling out, you know, an older fighter. But I do think that they're really depending on him to like, you know, drive these subscriptions. Another thing, Triple G signed with DAZN. That's not news. But big news was him getting rid of Abel Sanchez. Did you have any inclination that that was going to happen? I know you're pretty close. You have a pretty good working relationship with Golovkin.
Yeah, no. I mean, there were no problems between Golovkin and Abel Sanchez up until the money start getting discussed. And that came around right after the DAZN deal was signed. We all know the numbers with that. They're extraordinary for Golovkin. And I think Abel wanted his piece of the pie and wanted to get paid according to the work he has done, not just as a trainer, but also as kind of a co-promoter to all this, because Abel Sanchez, you know, is a great talker and Gennady is not. So he's able to sell some of these fights with some of the things that he said. I mean, I was at the press conference for the last week's DAZN fight with Estrada and Sorungvisai, and the news broke and I called Abel from the press conference and he just unloaded. He said,
I know,
he called them. He called them ungrateful. I'm forgetting his exact quote right now, but you know, greedy. And it was ugly, and it is ugly between those two guys. So it's unfortunate because they have one of the strongest, or had one of the strongest fighter-trainer relationships that we've seen in boxing in a while. But it seems like that bridge has been pretty firmly burned.
Have you heard any replacements? I know there's, you know, go on Twitter. You're not going to – I mean, some crazy names get thrown out there. But have you heard anything about a replacement for Abel Sanchez for Triple G?
Well, I know two things. One, Freddie Roach is not doing it because Freddie was asked about a million times last week if he was doing it, and he has not heard anything from Gennady Golovkin's team. I have been told that it's not going to be a situation where he pulls kind of a Klitschko, Jonathan Banks, and pulls somebody within his own camp to do it. He is going to go out and look for a outside trainer to step in. A name that I've heard floated is Joe Goosen. Joe is Southern California-based, and you know, is more of a motivator too. And maybe that's what Gennady needs at this point. Someone to get in his ear and just kind of push him that extra mile a little bit. Doesn't need someone to change him technically at this stage of his career. But we're coming up on it. I mean, he's going to have to get into camp, you know, very soon if he's not already and start working towards this June fight.
Another thing, though, I'm thinking about with Abel Sanchez and to see how he reacts or his reaction to this. You know, if you're a fighter, would you be a little skeptical to sign on with Abel Sanchez if say something goes wrong, he's just going to trash you afterwards?
I mean, at a certain level, maybe if you're a top level guy looking for a trainer, possibly. But if you're a younger guy and you know you need somebody to guide your career, Abel did a terrific job. Yeah. I mean, Gennady came over and he was already a recognized world title holder, but Abel did a terrific job in helping him really adapt to the pro style, sit down his punches, and become the star that he is today. So I think that's more valuable and resonates more with fighters than what happened at the end. We see, you know, when Freddie Roach broke up with Pacquiao and Emmanuel Stewart's had stuff happen in the past, like there, it happens sometimes when things end badly. It's the level of trainer that I think fighters are interested in.
Yeah, no, I think on the discussion is like, what's more important here? Is it the fighter? Is it the trainer? Is it 50-50? It's interesting because this just opened up a whole new discussion in the boxing community. Let's talk about Anthony Joshua quickly. His opponent, have you hearing anything about this? Because that's another fight that's right around the corner. I know that Ruiz seems like he's a favorite. There are some matchroom guys in there. What's the latest on Anthony Joshua and who he could be fighting on June 1st?
Yeah, I was told that Ruiz is a pretty strong favorite to the point where I'm a little surprised it wasn't announced this past weekend. I'm sure are a lot of cooks in the kitchen here. There's the matchroom people and what they want. There's the DAZN side and what they want. And of course, Madison Square Garden is involved in this decision as well. So there are a lot of people weighing in on all this, but everything I've heard over the last week or so has leaned towards Andy Ruiz. He's coming off that win a knockout win on national TV. So that gives him a bit of a boost. He's more of a well-known name than, say, a Michael Hunter is. Right. So I think Ruiz is there. The question, and this is like, I mean, there's so much back and forth, but Luis Ortiz turning it down is just completely crazy, like out of his mind crazy. Luis Ortiz is probably never going to make $7 million in a fight, no matter who he fights. And that is what I was told, what he was offered all in to fight Anthony Joshua. If he turned that down, he needs to fire all the people, or at least I don't like to say fire people, but he needs to have a serious conversation with the people around him about what happened in that situation.
Well, I mean, I watched some video yesterday on his trainer, and I'm like about 30 seconds in, and he's like, $5 million wasn't enough. That's when I just turned off the video, and I was like, all right, that's what they're talking. Like, $5 million is not enough when his highest purse was $500,000 for Wilder. Unless Heyman is promising him, you know, crazy amount of money for the Wilder rematch. I tweeted this last week. I think that Joshua and Ortiz could have fought. Ortiz puts up a valiant effort. He loses. He could still go back to Wilder and still get – that's a double payday. So you're right. Absolutely head-scratching decision from Team Ortiz.
And that's where it gets tricky, too, because it seems like everybody's getting promised Deontay Wilder to keep them out of an Anthony Joshua fight. I mean, you know, Adam Konacki, you know, one thing I heard recently was that he really isn't in great shape right now. And, you know, not ready for, you know, a six-week training camp might be too fast for him to be in a reasonable position. So I buy that. Plus, I think he's going to get a multi-fight deal as part of the PBC package. And he deserves it because he's a very popular guy and a fun fighter to watch. But Luis Ortiz is just a complete head scratcher. And look, he better look at his promoters and managers and said, look, at a bare minimum, I was promised $5 million. In my next fight, I want $5 million. Because you're right. Even if he lost, he'd still have $5 million and lost Anthony Joshua, right, and probably still be in the mix to fight Deontay Wilder. If he won, all of a sudden you got a rematch with Joshua, a unification fight with Wilder. You are 10 times more valuable if you take that fight against Anthony Joshua. That is the most puzzling of it all.
Crazy, crazy times in the world of boxing. Crazy times in the NBA. Crazy times in Chris Mannix's life right now. I know it's a busy, busy time for you. We got a Worldwide Wob coming on the show next, and we're going to talk about a little NBA brawls. I helped him out with a piece that ran on the Action Network. Serge Ibaka is one of the worst fighters. Who is the worst NBA fighter you've ever seen covering the NBA?
You know, God, there's so many bad ones.
I've watched a lot of them.
And I can't even tell if they're bad fighters or they just clearly recognize that if they connect on a punch, it's probably at least a 5-game suspension, if not more, and millions of dollars potentially if they're high salary guys out of their pocket. I remember the Carmelo Anthony, I think it was a J.R. Smith fight years ago in New York, where I think Carmelo just kind of, if I remember correctly, was just moonwalking the entire way through that fight. And there was the old Alonzo Mourning with, you know, Jeff Van Gundy attached to his leg back in the day.
I scoured over that one. And the best one that I watched was Chris Child's two-piece combination that he landed on Kobe, which was stuff of legends.
Yeah, there was a time, you know, before David Stern and Adam Silver really cracked down on all this, there was a time the guys would, you know, throw punches. But now you don't even leave the bench because, you know, 1-game suspension is coming. And with these types of salaries, that's a whole lot of money you're not going to get.
There it is. Chris Mannix, appreciate the time. This Saturday will be on the call for the biggest fight of the year, Danny Jacobs and Canelo Alvarez. Thanks for the time, Chris.
My pleasure.
If you've been consumed with Game of Thrones, then you probably have not been following up on the boxing news this week. There's a lot of items that are going on, a lot of big-time boxing news. We get you all caught up with this week's, in case you missed it. We'll start off with Devin Haney. Devin Haney signs with Matchroom. This is a huge signing for Eddie Hearn and his Matchroom USA outfit. Devin Haney was a big-time free agent. He was a very interesting case because this was a kid who's 20 years old, 21-0. He's ranked in the top 10 in all three of the governing bodies, number three in the WBC. We'll touch on that in a second. But this is huge for Eddie Hearn because Devin Haney's a kid that is looked at in the same regard as Teofimo Lopez. I think Teofimo's slightly ahead of him prospect-wise. And I don't even think they're prospects, actually. I think these are legit contenders at this point. But Haney was interesting because he was kind of promoting himself. He had a very interesting setup, if you've been following along with him. Lives out in Las Vegas, you know, he's got a ton of money, ton of cars, has that whole Mayweather outlook, and it seemed like he was going to kind of do this on his own and kind of take the Mayweather approach before Mayweather left Top Rank. Not the case, so I'm wondering how much money Matchroom and Annie Hearn threw at him, because it seemed like he was content on doing his own thing, but he signs with Matchroom, huge signing for them, and it kind of shakes things up, or not really shakes things up, but sets the picture a little bit for what's going to go on in that weight class. Will he fight Luke Campbell now? Luke Campbell is the mandatory now, or the number one contender in the WBC. It was like a jockeying for position on who's going to fight Luke Campbell. For a while, we thought it was going to be Teofimo Lopez. Now, does Devin Haney slide right into there and take that? If that's the case, then you can maybe see Richard Comey fight Teofimo Lopez. But that's probably not going to happen next, because I spoke to Richard Comey at Broway Boxing, and he seems like he's going to come back in June with a voluntary defense and then maybe fight in December. Where does Lomachenko sit here? Was Lomachenko going to, you know, kind of springboard over Devin Haney and fight Luke Campbell or fight Richard Comey? So that division certainly heating up. A lot of moving parts here, but Devin Haney signs on with Matchroom and DAZN. Huge, huge signing for Eddie Hearn. He is a fighter that is going to be a world champion. It's just a matter of time. Moving forward here, we just talked about the lightweight division and why the picture has opened up in the WBC. It's because Mikey Garcia officially announced that he is vacating his WBC lightweight belt. He has now the champion emeritus distinction, which is very rare, not given out very lightly by the WBC. Basically, what it means is that Mikey Garcia, should he choose to fight again at 135, that he'll be immediately get a title shot, immediately get a chance to win back his title. That's what that champion emeritus means. But he says his next fight will either be at 140 or 147. That's Mikey Garcia. Like we said, Luke Campbell is now the challenger or the number one contender for the WBC. But Garcia was on Inside PBC Boxing on Fox. And he talked about how there are some names at 147 that he still wants to go after. I think that's a little far-fetched. I think we saw what would happen at 147 when he fights a bigger guy. Maybe he should go to 140. There's certainly a lot of names at 140 that he can fight and he can take home a belt. So obviously everyone wants to see him fight Lomachenko. I mean, is that going to happen? Who knows? But Mikey Garcia, I don't think he's going to fight at 147. Don't think he's going to fight at 135. Perfect middle ground. 140. Also, don't think he's going to come back anytime soon, because he took an absolute shellacking to Errol Spence. He'd be smart to sit out for at least, you know, another 6-7 months. Biggest news of the week, and something that caught everyone off guard, and we just spoke about it with Chris Mannix to get some more, you know, news on this. That's Triple G splitting with Abel Sanchez. Obviously, over money, things got ugly really, really fast. You had Abel Sanchez, who's never afraid to say what's on his mind, never one to mince words. You had Triple G's statement put out there that, you know, I had a wonderful 9 years with Abel, and he brought me to places, and it was very, you know, cordial and like your traditional press release. Then you had Abel Sanchez come out, and you knew he was going to come with some heat. Apparently, it's all over money. It has nothing to do with the fact that he was not really trained properly, didn't have the greatest game plan for that second Canelo fight. All over money. He's making $100 million now with this new DAZN deal. It's pretty clear that Abel Sanchez wants to keep the 10%. So that would make him, you know, $10 million. So I think that Golovkin offered him a lower price, and he didn't think it was enough. So he went from not taking any money to he owes him 5%. So that's interesting. So he offered him 5% instead of the 10, so obviously a pay cut. So he's probably thinking, Abel Sanchez is thinking, why? You know, why, if you're making more, why all of a sudden am I making less? So it set off a debate, or it set off something that boxers and trainers have been working on for a very long time. That's how much they're getting paid. So now, like, the boxing Twitterverse and the fans are starting to understand, they're taking sides here. Who's more important? Is it the trainer? Is it the fighter? Who do we give more credit to? Is the fighters in the ring, you know, actually taking the punches? But when you're at the level that Golovkin's at, you know, you've reached the pinnacle and now you're on the tail end of your career. You know what you have to do when you step in the ring. You know you have your game plan. So maybe it's a motivational thing. And when it's a motivational thing, you need a new voice in your ear. So I'm not really surprised that he separated from Joe Goosen. Is a name that Chris Mannix threw out, and it's a name that a lot of people have thrown out. I love Joe Goosen. I think he is a great trainer. Look what he did with Lipinets. Look what he's done with everyone that he's worked with in his career. So that would be interesting. And finally from here, Ishae Smith. Yes, before you say, you know, what does Ishae Smith know? Like, he's a journeyman in his career. But Ishae Smith is a fighter that has been a part of a lot of training camps. He was with Floyd Mayweather for years. He's been a part of Hall of Fame training camps. He knows what goes on behind the scenes with trainers and fighters. He tweeted out some interesting stuff here. He said, most top boxers you've watched over the years, especially pay-per-view fighters, have not paid a trainer 10%. He knows this as a fact because he was in camp with a lot of Hall of Fame fighters. They told me themselves that there was a flat fee, no more 10%. And he went on to say that if a fighter makes $500 million, you would want 50. And for a fact, the fighters reach a certain level and the 10% goes out the window. Oscar never gave Floyd 10%, Floyd Sr. I know that for a fact. So there's some insight on it that just because you reach a certain amount of money doesn't mean you're going to get that 10%. Interesting times in the trainer world, and I don't think that Sanchez did himself any favors by trashing Golovkin if he wants to add more star clients to his pretty big regime that he's got here. Finally, Marcos Maidana cuts ties with his retirement plan. He retires once again. I hate to say this, but I saw it coming. I think we all saw it coming. He says he doesn't have the enthusiasm anymore. So he pretty much lost 44 pounds for no reason. He interrupted his drinking time. He interrupted his time of shooting guns into rivers because he wanted to come back. I think that Fox had him slated for this July card, which is supposedly going to be Pacquiao Thurman. They were going to slide him in there. He was going to fight Francisco Santana, probably at 168 or 160. He said, no mas, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. And it makes sense. I mean, he was 35 years old. How hard is it to cut weight when you're in your 30s? Tyson Fury was able to do it because he was legitimately 30 years old, and his body could do it. 35, after being off for, 5 years, the lifestyle that Maidana was living over in Argentina, blowing up, he was huge. He was legitimately huge. So now he goes back to Argentina and he can live his life. He can keep on tweeting pictures and we can go back to loving Marcos Maidana. But happy trails to Mr. Marcos Maidana. Enjoy retirement once again. And that's it for this week's In Case You Missed It. Our next interview on Inside Boxing Live is brought to you by Jack Doyle's Restaurant and Bar. Jack Doyle's Restaurant and Bar, located just a few steps away from Madison Square Garden and Times Square. Go into Jack Doyle's for all your entertainment needs. From happy hours to birthday parties to private events, Jack Doyle's has you covered. Once again, that's Jack Doyle's Restaurant and Bar, located on 240 West 35th Street. Our next guest here on Inside Boxing Live, he's big in the Twitter world covering the world of basketball, but as I'll talk about next, basketball and the world of boxing have a lot of overlaying tendencies and themes, and we're going to bring in right now Worldwide Wob, Mr. Rob Perez. You know him on Twitter, one of the best Twitter follows you can possibly have there on the Twitter machine. Mr. Rob Perez, what's going on, man?
Not a whole lot. Just waking up. We're recording this just a couple hours after the Game of Thrones episode ended. Yes. We had Rockets Clippers. We had Rockets. That's how crazy it's been. I forgot the names of the teams. We had Rockets Warriors and just a weekend of hoops and big fights with Crawford last weekend, obviously. So a lot going on. It never stops in this content business. So it's all good.
All right. The reason I have you on here is because you and I collaborated on a piece. You hit up me up at CompuBox, and you're working on a story about why NBA basketball players are so terrible at fighting. And it's funny because we would do stats on these fights, and someone would alert me like, hey, there was a big fight in the NBA, Chris Paul recently, and Serge Ibaka, and we'll talk about Serge Ibaka in a little bit. And I would go look for the best footage of it, and I would see Worldwide Wob would have the best footage of it. I'm like, all right, who's Worldwide Wob anyway? So I would retweet it, and then we would throw our stats on it. And then, you hit me up for this piece, and I thought it was absolutely hilarious. Pretty much what it was is you went over some of the most prolific fights in NBA history, asked us to do some stats for it. You know, as you were looking over this stuff, what did you think of some of these fights?
Well, it was the first – Serge Ibaka is the culprit here. He's the main test subject, because after he fought Marquise Chriss this year in the Cleveland Cavaliers, it was a completely random fight. Yeah. Serge Ibaka whiffed unlike I've ever seen him whiff. And this is about the third or fourth time that he's whiffed. So now I have to start asking the question, why is Serge Ibaka so bad at fighting? Because he's not afraid to throw hands. He's not one of those hold me back guys. Mm-hmm. He has gotten into plenty of altercations, as you quickly learned throughout his NBA career. But he's never close to landing a punch. And how is somebody this athletically gifted this poor at fighting? So then the bigger picture came in here of why do NBA players all stink at fighting? Yeah. And it's not just the hold me back stuff, but there are only a couple examples throughout time, NBA history, where there is a solid punch connect. What is the explanation here? So I thought there was no better person to bring in than the CompuBox owners themselves to kind of help us dissect this. And maybe it's something with their technique, their form. They got a bunch of dudes in their way trying to like push them. Whatever the reason was, is, or forever will be, NBA players stink at fighting, I think, is ultimately what we determined here.
Yeah, and the piece, it was awesome. It was great. And in looking over some of the fights, I mean, obviously I'm an NBA fan, so I'll see some of the fights and people hit me up. And boxing Twitter would always hate these fights. Like, they would be posting, they'd be like, it wasn't a fight. And like, they would always like look down upon like NBA players and like, these guys can't fight. But a big reason, we just had Chris Mannix on and he brought up a good point, the fact that they can certainly land. Like, I know these guys can land, but they just don't want to because they don't want to be suspended five games. That's five paychecks or five game checks.
I don't buy that because there is legitimate intent. We've seen the Shaquille O'Neal fights from that article, and yeah, there's videos of it as well where he just, if he connected on Brad Miller, the famous one, when he was playing for the Lakers, Brad Miller would be dead right now. Yes. We would be having a conversation about how NBA fights never happen because of what happened between Shaq and Brad Miller. Yeah. And I understand how hockey fans especially look down on us because our guys fight every single night and we stand there and we let it happen while NBA is just like pushing and threats and pointing. Yeah. Maybe that's what makes it so great, is when there is an actual real fight. Yeah. It's like, oh crap, that like this is actually going down. So maybe that's I don't know, but with NBA fights, when you get a real one, I don't think it's because they don't want to fight. They clearly do, because tensions get high, and I think just masculinity and testosterone take over. They just stink at fighting. Yeah. We've determined this. They're just bad at fighting. End of story.
It's funny you bring up the NHL. Last week, Ovechkin, did you see that fight? I mean, that was nasty stuff, and it made me think, like, I can't believe in today's world that the NHL still allows them. They're fighting with just bare knuckles, and they're just blasting each other. And the refs just allow it. And he absolutely laid out this, like, 20-year-old player. I don't know what his name was. We did the stats on it. But it's pretty wild that the NBA obviously doesn't want fights, but the NHL is so open to it.
Well, I think the NHL, if the stuff that happens with Ovechkin, again, for people that didn't watch that, Ovechkin just straight up knocked out a dude.
Cold.
Like, dangerously knocked out a dude. Maybe they're going to require that you can continue to fight, but you got to keep your gloves and helmets on, because if you throw the gloves like you're supposed to, then it becomes a bare knuckle fight and you go up against someone like Ovechkin that has the power to actually seriously hurt somebody. Yeah. I think it takes that one time, that malice at the palace per se, for hockey, for the rules to change.
Talking about how you got into covering the NBA and how you got such a big following, tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. It's been I haven't had like what I like to call a Ken Bone moment. And if you remember Ken Bone, he was the guy at the presidential debates that stood up and asked that funny question and hockey stick viraled overnight. For me, it's just been a very slow organic drip of being a basketball fan. So I just created a Twitter account like everyone else did about 10 years ago. It had always been kind of part time, just kind of tweeting out my thoughts about the NBA. And I've evolved throughout the years with the technology. So as we progressed towards the year of like 2013, 2014, I was able to illustrate what it was I was watching on the games now on the internet through an app called Vine. And I know RIP Vine is like a thing now.
I miss Vine every day.
Yeah. At one point, like, you couldn't put videos on the internet just as much as 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
So I was able to start illustrating the things I was seeing and all the jokes and the actual analysis. It helped me just kind of evolve a bigger audience because I wasn't restricted to just 140 characters. Mm-hmm. You progress another couple years after that, and then here comes Periscope, which was an opportunity for me to live broadcast to the world. And now after these games are over, I'm getting, you know, just I'm having a post-game show per se. There's no real post-game show other than SportsCenter or inside the NBA once a week for NBA specifically, that something big just happened in the league. I'm going to go live and talk about it. But that didn't start like where it is now. That started with 50 people in there watching me cook pizza rolls at 3 o'clock in the morning on the West Coast because I struck out at the bar. Mm-hmm. But 50 people developed into 500 because I started going at normal hours and talking about things of substance. And we built this kind of community and culture over the past decade that has gotten us to this point. So it definitely wasn't one of those like this, you know, just kind of happened. I think it's just been putting in the work and then kind of moving over towards full time and honestly just using the resources that were available to me and staying ahead of the technology.
In the world of boxing, a few years ago, the first thing that comes to mind, the craziness of boxing, Juan Manuel Marquez, who fought Pacquiao 4 times, he did it, they did a 24/7 and he was sitting after training and he drank his own urine. And people like when that's like the bizarre, you're not gonna see that in the NBA, but it certainly goes down that path of how like strange the world of like the NBA outside of the court, and same thing with boxing. It's wild.
So boxing's biggest challenge now moving forward is their equivalent of LeBron James, which was Floyd Money Mayweather to the common fan, is gone. Right. He retired out of the league. Right. So what does the NBA do when LeBron, you know, disappears? Is they're going to fall back on the Giannis Antetokounmpos and Durants and the Embiids. Boxing's big challenge is how are they going to continue to sell these billion-dollar fights, the Mayweather Pacquiao's? That should have happened 5 years ago. Right. How do we make that happen now and get the world back super interested in boxing? Because like you, myself, and everyone watching this, we could watch Lomachenko, Crawford, you name, I could watch Tyson Fury box all day and day. But you can't really sell that to the world in terms of 10 out of 10 people on the sidewalk are talking about it the next day. Right. So I think that is their biggest challenge, is how do we sell this next superstar? Is it somebody that's cocky like Mayweather, or is it a genuine like happy-go-lucky guy like Triple G? Mm-hmm. That's what they need to figure
out. Yeah, it's tough. It's a niche sport right now. I mean, it's never going to die, and it's never going to get to the levels it was in the 80s, but it would be nice to kind of up the profiles of Deontay Wilders and whatnot. But now, let's go through some of these fights, man. Let's talk about some of these fights that these basketball brawls, I don't want to, should we call them fights? We'll call them interactions.
Altercations,
hold me back. These are a few that I loved that we talked about. The first one was Shaq versus Robertson. Shaq lands the hardest punch. I gave him an 8 out of 10. He lands the hardest punch out of all that you sent me. He went 1-for-1 with the power shot. Shaq was an interesting case because we talked about him and Brad Miller, who grazed his ear. The footage was just, I think it was like standard definition days, but it grazed his ear. But this shot that he landed on Robinson was short, compact. It was everything you want to see from a fighter.
What do you think of it? Was like a closed fist slap, though, because he like looks at him, looks down on him, takes his fist out, shows it to him, and just whap, like across. I mean, he makes like as solid of a connection as possible, and getting hit by anything by Shaq is like dangerous. But what if he had actual form there and used it like in the form of a jab?
He would have been dead as well.
Because remember, the famous one that Shaq has is with Charles Barkley, right. And he comes in with a straight left that would have killed almost any human on the spot, like disintegrated them into dust. Yeah. But with Robertson, because he's so little, he's not going to punch down on him. Maybe that's why fights are so bad in the NBA, is because of the height difference. Yes. He would have had to punch down on him, so he took out his fist and he just went like hammer style UFC. I guess it worked and it knocked Robertson back, but I don't know if it was the greatest form in the world.
No, but it was the hardest. And I think, yes, if he using the open hand is such like a blatant sign of disrespect. It's like in the 0.5 seconds it takes me to realize I'm about to throw a punch, but I'll also realize that I'm much bigger than you, so I'll give you the benefit of the doubt and I'll open up my hand and slap you, but still register 8 out of 10 on my scale. Next fight that I loved, and this isn't because I'm a huge Knicks fan and I loved Chris Childs, but I talked about this in the piece where I helped you out. It's the lead right hand of Chris Childs. I said that, you know, Floyd Mayweather perfected the lead right hand. It's one of the hardest punches to throw in boxing. And Chris Childs comes along, throws a lead right, and then follows it up with a left. Like, very rarely do we see one punch land. But you got Chris Childs here throwing combinations on arguably one of the best NBA players of all time. I love this one.
So my question is, does Chris Childs have weak punch power or does Kobe Bryant have a strong chin?
That's could be a little bit of both.
He took two of them like it was nothing. He didn't even like stagger back hardly. Yeah. I would probably say this is the best form of any punch that we analyzed.
I agree.
Because he's actually got the stance and he landed the straight, you know, straight right like you talk about and came back with kind of like a hook per se. But there had to be no power on that because the form was so nice. You'd assume Kobe Bryant would be on the ground or he could just take a punch. So this is easily the most famous one because of the two-piece. But as a Knicks fan, you know, we've been through so many of these brawls through the 90s that this one probably stood out just because it was the one time that the Knicks actually won, like undoubtedly. But did they win is my question. If Kobe didn't go down, who actually won that?
It's tough.
Maybe because Kobe didn't fight back.
Kobe, and he's got the reflexes too, Kobe, because we saw with the ball fake. Or was that because he wasn't the Matt Barnes? He was next to him, right? When the overhead, right. The overhead blew that one whole thing. But yeah, I mean, Childs throwing that two-piece. It's very rare you see one punch land unless you're, you know, Robin Ventura. A two-piece. Robin Ventura and Nolan Ryan. Nolan Ryan landed like 15 shots when he had them in his head. It just blasted them. That one I love, not just because I'm a huge Knicks fan. How about we talked about Ibaka and the fact that he could never land a punch. That was your main thing. We talked about that. LJ and Alonzo Mourning, another seminal moment in my childhood. I was equally fired up and equally traumatized. Fired up to see a fight, traumatized to see Van Gundy like a squirrel on someone's leg, like holding on. Like I was like 10 years old, didn't know what to make of that, but I thought it was amazing. But that one was interesting because there was a lot of like infighting before the fight actually started. Like there was like a few jabs, then they started going at it, and then, you know, Alonzo Mourning, obviously that had everything. You know, you had like leg locks, you had chokehold. Oakley came in and just straight up like a bouncer at a club just moved him out of there. But I think that one is up there in terms of like one of the most memorable fights.
So this fight in particular has a lot of buildup to it, and not just the actual fight itself. Like you said, there was a couple punches thrown, then it turned out into an all-out brawl. But you have to understand, Larry Johnson and Alonzo Mourning never liked each other. They were teammates on a playoff Charlotte Hornets team, and they did not like each other. They both thought they were the stars. They had a very much a Kobe Bryant Shaq thing going on, that who's the alpha here? Because you're not the alpha because I'm the alpha type thing. So they never got along. And then when it became Heat Knicks in the Garden on a big game, and they ended up going eye to eye like that, it was 10 years of, all right, let's get this out of our system right now. I would have preferred that there was no brawl. They just let them actually figure it out themselves. But that's the famous Van Gundy play coming in there.
God.
Like, is that count as a leg lock of some kind?
I count it as a leg lock.
Like, what kind of damage does that do? But at the very least, it kind of kept Alonzo in place for a brief second. But more importantly to me, this was finally, at long last, when you're waiting for either the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight, this is what it was in the 90s for the NBA, because these two were destined to fight each other at some point, and it finally culminated at this point.
Right, in the playoffs nonetheless, too, when you don't want your guys to be out for the next game. Coming off the bench was always a big thing. That's another thing I noticed, is that a lot of the better fights happened either in the early 2000s or the 90s. So it wasn't like, I feel like now, maybe there's more their Twitter involved. Do you see a correlation on why the fights were better? Or do you think it's just maybe the style of play was a little more rough?
I think the NBA is honestly just trying to limit them. Yeah. So if you come off the bench, you get suspended. It's what happened to the Suns, right? Ultimately cost them the series. You know what they don't want? They don't want the Vernon Maxwell thing to happen, where we all talk about Malice at the Palace being the worst thing that's ever happened to the NBA.
Yeah.
Vernon Maxwell, during a timeout, stood up, walked into the stands, knocked out a fan, and then walked back to the bench like nothing happened, and got the play call like, okay, what are we running? The NBA can't have that anymore with social media. 2019 is a completely different world than it was in the 90s.
Yeah.
So they just can't have, they don't want the NBA brand to be known for like those NHL type fights.
Right.
They want it to be known for basketball and obviously other things. And I think ultimately they're just trying to limit those, that type of exposure, even though it's great for content consumers like us.
All right, not to get too serious, but everything that's going on too with the fans, you know, like, you know, yelling at Russell Westbrook or what happened in Utah. I mean, yeah, you're right. You don't want another Malice in the Palace, because
that encourages that too.
Exactly.
If you encourage fighting, it's going to encourage that type of behavior from the fans.
How about this, Rob? Did you know that Kendall Gill called a major fight this past weekend in the world of boxing?
I did not know that.
I did not want to prime you on that. I didn't want to tell you that early. I wanted to see your reaction to that. I mean, I know he has a four-fight career, so he fought actually in four professional fights. He's 4-0. But I know he was like dabbling and calling fights, and it was on DAZN. It was a World Boxing Super Series main card, and Kendall Gill, and he got rave reviews.
Wow. So Kendall Gill was at some point was a part of that Alonzo Mourning, Larry Johnson Hornets team, if I'm not mistaken. So maybe that's where he got his fighting inspiration from, was just watching his teammates go at it. The other NBA player that I know has that type of experience, he's famous for it. It's James Johnson. Serge Ibaka was involved with an altercation and missed once again with James, but he like totally backed off because the whole world knows James Johnson is a like licensed professional MMA fighter.
Oh, wow.
And you don't mess with James Johnson. But I didn't know Kendall Gill would have been the absolute last guy I thought of.
Right.
Like, I'm thinking of Isaiah Riders and Gilbert Arenas's that I would figure were professional fighters before Kendall Gill. But now I will tune in because of it.
Not only Kendall Gill, yeah, not only is he a fighter, but now he's, you know, part of major productions calling fights. It's wild. I talked to Chris Mannix about this. There's a lot of NBA players that are huge boxing fans, none bigger than Dame Lillard. I know that he's like not just like a casual, he knows like everything that's going on in the world of boxing.
Yeah, so I think NBA players appreciate the art of it. You know, boxing to me has always been an art versus something like UFC or MMA, which is like just pure humans trying to kill each other.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, there is a little artistry to boxing just because of the history and the what you're allowed to do. I guess your question is, why do NBA players love it so much?
Yeah.
I think they're friends with a lot of boxers.
Yes.
You know, they're at a lot of events together. They're completely different ends of the athletic spectrum. So it's not someone that's ever going to be competitive for me. We can be boys. And a lot of these guys also had similar upbringings as well. So I'm sure Damian Lillard, you know, he pimps all the time that he's from East Oakland, and it's the reason why he is who he is because he's from East Oakland. And when you grow up in that type of community, I'm sure there are a lot of people who are fighting for a living that he grew up with and now are on the professional circuit. So there's just a lot of similarities, not only in terms of interests, but I know these guys and I can relate to them because they went through something similar that I did at one point.
Yeah, it's funny because Mayweather would always fight in May or September, and it's either the NBA playoffs or, you know, training camp just starting. But when he fought McGregor, it was a month before. He fought him in August, and that's when I saw it. It was all NBA. I mean, I was sitting in front of Harden. He was there. LeBron was there. There were a ton of NBA. I went to use the bathroom in between fights, and Rudy Gobert was in the urinal, and his head was outside of the urinal. And I'm just like, whoa, that guy is in the NBA. So it was. I saw it like more the fact that you know, Mayweather fighting in was it August? More NBA players came out, and then you see this correlation. And I think you nailed it there with the fact that they can kind of see themselves in fighters who usually come from, you know, rough and tumble areas. And you see that all the time. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, they get to live vicariously through Floyd Mayweather. You know, we want to brawl on the court, but we don't for whatever reason.
Right.
And it's a spectacle as well. So I'm going to show up here. I'm going to support the guy that I feel like I relate most to. And it feels like they're like, if we ever had a flagrant foul, I would want to be doing this to the guy that flagrant fouled me. So there's a laundry list of reasons why, you know, NBA players relate to these guys. But certainly the spectacle of it all, something like McGregor, Mayweather, is going to draw the biggest names. And they want to be front and center.
Rob Perez, Action Network, Worldwide Wob. It's great to see your face because for a while I thought that you were Adam Silver.
I get that a lot, but I've been consistent with it since day one. I've had two avatars. I've had David Stern, and then when David Stern retired, three days later, the NBA commissioner rose again. There's too many religious things to talk about there, but Adam Silver became the NBA commissioner of my avatar, so I can't change it at this point.
No, you got to stay consistent.
Yeah.
Wob's fist percentage case study, basketball brawls, punching inefficiency. I was really happy to work with you on that. I thought it came out great. Let's talk again soon, man. I really enjoyed this.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Rob.